You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The Early Years.
Assault on Precinct 13.
Okay, welcome to the second season of the Surgeons of Horror podcast. Its purpose is to look into the horror films, dissecting them one screen legend at a time. Our second horror legend and focus for the upcoming seasons will be director, writer, producer, musician, you could probably throw in there. John Carpenter, who gave us, the team at Surgeons of Horror podcast, the impetus to gather ourselves together and look back at his career and the impact it had on the horror film genre. That's really off-putting, man.
I'm doing the thing.
I know you are.
It's awesome.
I think your synth is broken.
So in order to successfully do this, though, we need a team of horror aficionados who will form the surgical team each episode. So let me introduce you. First up is yours truly, Paul Farrell, lead surgeon and host of the series of the podcast. Self-confessed horror freak who grew up drawn to the dark work of the silver screen, threw myself into that arena with a lot of relish and glee, may I add. Joining me each episode at the Operating Theatre is a select team of horror aficionados who are hand-selected to perform the surgical task of dissecting each movie. On hand with me for this particular episode is Chief Anaesthetist. And I hate that word. So we're calling the Big Cheese from now on.
Big Cheese!
And that's Anthony Yee.
Hello!
Who offers an... who offers an insightful study into the art of cellulite.
Does he, like... Do you think he makes four notes, and then the music composer, and, like, he just says, I'll take that percentage of the budget of music, whatever the music composer budget is, whatever film he does.
Yeah.
I'll take that. Here's five notes on a loop.
Well, he's going a bit crazy at the moment with, like, all these gigs and stuff. Like, people are flocking to it.
Oh, his music is great. Don't get me wrong.
It sounds really, really good.
Yeah, so,
I'm not offending his music.
He's even, like, a gun for hire for other film, horror film or film kind of makers now that will get him in to do the music for him. Because
without even trying, like, it's just effortless.
It's something,
But what's it, the thing is, bum, bum.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, that's it.
That's it.
I feel that moment when Spielberg first, when John Williams went, hey, here's the thing for Jaws.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, funny, what do you got? No, that was it. Cash or check.
That's right. I've listed here that your skill set. I have to move on, otherwise
we'll get to
an hour and 45 minutes that we did for the fucking country. Okay, so your skill set is that you are, and I guess as case in point, is that you have a keen eye for the slices of details. So you kind of narrow in on any of those imperfections and stuff that just ails the inquisitive mind.
The more irrelevant, the better.
Yeah. And to my left in the podcast booth is Chief Surgical Technician. Ben Skinner.
Guten Tag.
Throw in a little bit of a Euro language flavour into this.
We need to be more.
Yeah, we do. That's it. It's just not going to fly.
Because having one token Asian isn't enough.
And you are somebody who really gets into the guts of the subject, and that's kind of where I turn to you when we really want to talk about the nitty-gritty of the piece. So that's the team. Without further ado, let's dissect our second subject on the John Carpenter early sessions, and this subject is, of course, Assault on Precinct 13.
Yes,
so cute.
What?
You missed the cue.
It's like the Dirty Harry.
Like the little
Because every time they put out soundtracks of John Carpenter, those two songs are included.
Exactly.
Anyway, so, it's not even Precinct 13, but we'll get to that.
Soon. Yeah, we will. We will. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, like, as is the case, and if anyone's new listeners out there, what we tend to do is we go through the plot narrative and we rip it apart and dissect it and talk around it. And then we move into kind of talking about the players of the piece that were involved, any kind of standout performances, any scare factors, if it's leaning that way, a few director's notes, and then our final verdict. So let's get into the journey. We open with that music. Man, you're so shit at it. Which is iconic. Like, to me, like, we've had Dark Star already, but this is the first instance we've had of Carpenter's signature in his music, and I used to have this one as a ringtone for ages. Yeah, I love it. It's still one of my favorite tunes of his.
And even if you hadn't seen I'd be surprised if you hadn't heard this already before you saw the film, because
Yeah, it is, I hadn't seen the film when I got the songs of John Carpenter.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the few films I hadn't seen. And yeah. I was like, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, it's a good, it's a good, good beat. Yeah. So we open up in Anderson, California. It's an LA ghetto. We're told that it's Saturday and it's 3:10 a.m. Mm-hmm. We see six gang members from this gang called Street Thunder. They're going to terrorize.
Were they labeled Street Thunder?
Yeah, it came up on the radio a bit later on.
On the radio, okay. Yeah, yeah. Actually a dance crew.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We're Street Thunder!
Dangerous.
Also, they're a multiracial gang.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Multiracial gang! They're the worst gangs ever.
Yeah. Diversity.
Because they're vicious, but they get on.
But that's all right, because the police gunned them down in the middle of an alley.
Not much has changed.
No, that's right. We learned that through the radio that we learned that the juvenile gun problem is out of control, so kind of adding to that kind of tension that's set around the location. And we cut to our four warlords, as they're labeled in the credits.
Multiracial warlords.
White warlord, black warlord, Oriental warlord. And Chicano warlord.
They were Oriental in the credits. I love it.
Yeah, Oriental warlord.
I've not seen that in the 70s.
They sit around with a bunch of arsenal before cutting themselves, capture their blood in some form of pact.
They cut themselves with really big knives.
Yeah.
Pour like a gallon of blood each into this fishbowl. Totally fine.
Die on the spot. And that was the end of the film.
That's the film. Yeah. It's a cholo, which are really good with caramel in the movie.
Are you aware of this?
I read about it afterwards.
Okay.
It's a blood pact to fuck somebody up.
Okay, cool. Well, go on.
Yeah, well, no, it's interesting that you looked it up straight away.
Yeah.
Because it's just one of those things that's not really explained.
That's not explained.
Good. I like that it's not.
Other than the Welsh character kind of semi-knowing what it's about and going, that's crazy shit or something, a bit further down the down the track. So this all happens, so we can kind of start to learn that they're a bit fucked, these people in the head. We then come to daytime and we're introduced to Lieutenant Bishop as he gets into his car and heads off to work. He's assigned to... whistling a tune, which...
That was the thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. I've got this in the director's note, but this is John Carpenter. I'll say it now. John Carpenter has really wanted to make a Western.
That's supposed to be Rio Bravo, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Rio Bravo it's based on. So I don't know if the theme's from that or if it's just a nod to how... the cowboys or the heroes tend to whistle a lot.
They got a Western vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I've actually seen Rio Bravo a couple of times, and I found out that was his homage to it. It was really
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into that in the...
Go on. You gotta smoke.
Okay, that's number one. Okay.
Go on.
We'll get into the director's notes down the track. So anyway, Bishop then, this is where he learns that he's been assigned to Precinct 9. Yes, I said Precinct 9, Division 13.
Yes.
So it does make you wonder why it's called Assault on Precinct 13. It sounds better, man. Then call it Precinct 13.
But District 9 worked, but that was like not 20 years later.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I did think,
is this the prequel?
Flip, what's going to happen or something? Yeah, but anyway, the cool thing about that scene is that he's driving along, and three times this woman pulls up alongside, stares right down the camera, going, "What the hell's going on?" Because there's a camera rig in the car. It's not a sled.
Yeah.
I think it's just because he's black.
It was a black woman.
That's a black sheriff.
It was a black woman. Do you want to point that out? But just the look she gives right down the camera.
I thought there was going to be a drive-by. I actually thought that's what it was.
She's going to pull down. But you can see him acknowledge her, and he's trying to slow down while trying to accelerate. And twice she catches up with him, and you can tell he's up trying to look at him. I've only got one take. Stop reading it.
Well, it says a lot about the budget. And again, just to remind people, this was the second movie that Carpenter did. So not a lot of money left there. But it was the one that would cement the way forward for what would be his next movie, which we'll talk about a bit down the track.
Yeah.
This is where, as I said, he's learning he's going to Precinct 9, and we also learned that it's a precinct that's about to close down as well. So he's kind of going there on guard duty, essentially, just to make sure that...
To see it done.
Yeah, to see it through. We then cut to a prison where a prison transport is about to take place. We meet two convicts plus a third whose name is Wilson. You got a smoke?
Q smoke, yeah.
Which is where he says the line, "You got a smoke" for the first of many times.
I thought you were referencing Castaway.
I was, yeah. Wilson! Yes, he says he's got a smoke. Anybody got a smoke?
Wilson trips up the warden to play a trick on him.
He throws his chain around.
And kind of pulls him down. So that's kind of showing...
It's going to be a legitimate escape attempt, but it's more just fuck you, buddy.
Shits and giggles. So we're now at we're now at 5:37 p.m. and there's a guy called Lawson and his daughter Kathy in the car.
Like Kim Richards.
Kim Richards, man.
She was my high school, like my fantasy crush, but I didn't realize I grew up with her. That's why I was like,
you're the same age.
Yeah, when I had puberty, she had puberty. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, they all have those. I think Christina Ritchie was one.
Yeah.
Christina Ritchie. Oh, really? Julia Swala for me. Press gang.
Yes, press gang too. Yeah, she was my British version of that.
Yeah, that was where I went. Ooh. Linda Day. Tell me more.
Yeah,
and everyone listening just thinks we're creeps.
Yeah. Wait.
Wait, that's normal,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah. Stay tuned.
This is Kim Richards' is an annoying little girl.
Yeah, this is. We're talking. Not long after Little House on the Prairie kind of time, where that's what she was known for.
Disney.
That, the mountain. And we'll go to her as well and talk about that.
Race to the mountain.
Race to Brokeback Mountain. Race to. I'm gonna get that
first. It's a mashup.
So they're there to try and the father and daughter are there because they're in this neighborhood because they want to try and convince the nan that we don't see to move out of the tough neighborhood that they're in. We then see the gang, the four warlords roaming the streets, and they hop into a car and drive around and they're packing heat. Which I want to turn to you, Anne, for a moment because I know one of your bugbears is how guns are represented on movies. We're seeing a lot of Arsenal on show here.
Yes.
Believable?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Firstly, for the Mauser, which is the pistol they're carrying, the silencers that they're holding for that particular gun are way too short.
Yeah.
The betrayal silencers, which is a big plot point in this movie.
Yeah, it is.
Completely unrealistic. But they're unrealistic in most movies, in pretty much every movie.
Yeah.
Because they're silencers on revolvers, which don't exist.
Yeah.
Because they don't work. But also, Dirty Harry had silencers on revolvers, so that was, So far, I'm like, okay, whatever.
Yeah. Okay, so now we cut back to Bishop. So he actually now turns up at the precinct. There's a kind of bit where he observes the lay of the land before he goes in, so that gives the audience a sense of location. We see the car park.
Desolate.
Yeah, across the road with only a few cars there, and there's hardly anything there, like you said. Desolate. And then he goes into the precinct. This is where we meet Lee and Julie. I've put here down here they're secretaries at the station.
They're called secretaries.
Secretaries or are they? Because they
today you call them admin assistants.
Okay, cool.
They're civilians. They're not cops.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So they're and that's a really good point. They're civilians, not cops. That's an important point in this. And then we get the kind of slightly awkward dialogue between Bishop and Lee where she offers him coffee and he says, and how do you like it? Black and sweet like my men. No, that's different movie. That's when he says, black and I have been for over 30 years.
I don't think hello. It's so racist it's now cool again. Like, it's that come around?
Yeah.
That you can't get away with it now? But yeah, it is.
Anyway, does she laugh at all?
She's like a derisive look.
Oh, you.
Yeah. she gives him a look as if to say, I can't believe you said that.
Yeah.
It's really weird. She's interesting. Anyway.
It would be better if you looked at the camera after you said that.
Wink to four.
Know what I'm saying? Hey. 30 years. Anyway.
He's a chip, by the way. I just realised he's a California Highway Patrolman.
Yes,
he's a chick. That's why he's the same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's
yeah,
a chick.
Yeah,
he's a chick. He's a chick. He's
yeah.
a chick.
This is the bit where Poncho turns up. Yeah.
And who's the other one?
Hank.
George. I don't know.
Let's call him Bob.
Yeah.
So we also learn in this kind of interaction that Bishop grew up in the area that they're in, and more again, kind of. Laying the groundwork of that it is a fucking rough neighbourhood in case we weren't aware of that.
He tells the story of his dad sending him in.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which apparently happened at Alfred Hitchcock.
Really?
Supposedly, that's what I've been told.
That's pretty cool.
Mm.
And so, we get this kind of thing where she says to him, good job your parents got you out early, and he kind of makes a point, I actually grew up here until I was 20 and I left of my own accord.
Yes. Bitch.
Yeah. Take that. And I've been black for 30 years. So
this podcast is just about race.
It's going to be race. Yeah, well, like, this is a really, I'll mention it now. I have put it in the notes down the track, but Austin Stoker, who plays a bishop in this, is an African American. It's the first, one of the first films where we've seen an African-American play a lead in a film. Mm. And there's a lot of nods to Night of the Living Dead in this respect too.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there's a lot going on here, and it's deliberate, you know, and I think, you know, all jokes aside, this was quite a bold and courageous move
to do that. Yeah, I did wonder that. I was thinking in this game of context of Hollywood timeline, like how this actually fell in terms of,
Because he's the lead.
It would have been a big deal at the time.
Ah, for sure, for sure. Yeah.
Well, because they set up that first scene, was like, okay, is there going to be tension between him and Lee?
Yeah,
which would be a very bold move for Bradley Cooper to make. But then Wilson comes in, and then it's like a three-way tension, and it's symbolised by the fact that she just walks out. Not giving away the ending, but yeah, she chooses in a way at the end of the movie.
Can't believe he's spoilers, everyone.
I did.
Okay, so. So we get a lot of background anyway, essentially, of the Bishop character. He goes in to see the captain, who he's relieving for the day, or for the evening. So, and the captain's, again, talking about all these incidents that are occurring out on the streets. And before he then eventually leaves, handing over the keys, so to speak, to Bishop.
He loads a shotgun, puts inside a box and locks the box. Which I'm not too sure if you would do that.
Yeah,
load a weapon and then lock it in the box.
Which is key for later on.
It is. It's meant to be shipped out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very weird.
Anyway,
but anyway, I found that a bit weird.
Yeah, that's true. we then fast forward. It's 6:18 p.m. and the gang are cruising out in the streets. White Warlord sticks a gun out the window and starts eyeing off potential victims when he spies an ice cream van. I actually found that particular incident probably the most nerving.
It was, yeah.
I'm particularly like we see a lot of. Gun rage, gun incidents, gun crime incidents, and just to have that kind of fear factor of anyone could get
picked off.
And I found that probably overall the most haunting part of the movie.
Well, there's no particular motive behind it.
That's exactly it.
Usually, gang crime. If a civilian is killed, it's like collateral damage. But this is like targeted.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So the driver run, and then we cut to the ice cream driver, and he also notices the car cruising around. We then go back to the prison bus, and then we have Wilson waxing lyrical. We have the cop guy who asks why he killed those men. So that we're getting we never really find out what he did, although the hint there is that he killed a lot of people. We also learned that his first name is Napoleon as well. Just to make it obscure. That. This is probably the first instance of anti-hero characters that John Carpenter uses with quirky names, too.
Snake Plissken.
Snake Plissken. Yeah. Now, I'm going to say it now, but this, to me, this character of Napoleon Wilson, I feel really strongly, is an indicator or the first... the prototype of what Snake Plissken will be.
This
is why I think this is such an important movie.
Okay.
But... We'll move on to that down the track again. We also find out that one of the prisoners is sick on the bus.
Yes.
And so they're going to have to stop. And would you believe it? It's going to be at precinct nine. We then go back.
That's another moment where he looks the camera and there's a crash. Expecting to say 13, but he doesn't.
It's nine. Division 13. Lawson and his daughter, Kathy, pull over so that he can make a call from a public phone box because he's lost, I think, at this point.
Why didn't he use his mobile phone?
Doesn't have one, man. Doesn't have one. It's
not very
there expensive. Are a lot of phone boxes in this
hook. Yeah.
Not vandalized.
Yeah, work. That's a good point. Kathy sees the ice cream van, goes to buy one, and the driver is looking a bit nervous because that car is still circling around. As Kathy walks away, the white warlord pulls the driver out of the ice cream van and knocks him to the ground. Kathy realises that she has the wrong ice cream.
She literally goes, "Oh, fairy, this is a vanilla swirl."
And then goes back.
Yes.
Has she already licked, though? If you've licked, I believe, you know that's what it. What are you going to do?
Yes.
How would she know it's not the right flavour until she licks?
That's right.
No, so it's a swirl. Too. She wanted a...
Oh, like a proper...
This is a scoop. That's why. But, I mean, you'd say that.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. She pulled a scoop.
The fact that their character doesn't... Anyway,
what? She deserved to die.
Well, just to help the gene pool.
She realises she's got the wrong ice cream, goes back to the ice cream van, and White Warlord coldly shoots her point blank before then shooting the ice cream driver.
Without even looking, he shoots her.
Yeah.
And he shoots the wall, the ice cream dryer twice in the back.
Yep.
Yeah. And I don't know anything about this film, but I saw the remake. But I was like, holy fuck, Kim Richards just got killed.
Yeah.
And this is the scene that made it a seminal film for a lot of people. Because there's a lot of appearances where, a child is killed on camera.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm going to come to that in particular down the track, because there's something really important around that.
But it was like, oh my god. Yeah. I remember thinking, oh, that's a bit odd.
Even now, that would linger if you saw that in a movie now.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah, that's right.
Shooting a rabbit or shooting a dog, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so he's killed two people, and then Lawson, the father, runs over, and the ice cream driver, who's still alive, barely, at this point, tells him that he's got a gun in the van.
Gun underneath the dash.
And then Lawson then drives off in pursuit of the gang. Night falls, and Lawson catches up to the van, and he shoots and kills the white warlord.
How do you know that was the guy that killed his kid? Just picked one?
Yeah, just picked one.
Then he realises... Oh fuck, maybe that wasn't a good idea because I've just shot all six bullets I had to go.
Yeah.
And there's three of them still
and
alive.
And then three of them come out of the car. And then we get a chase on foot at this point. Why? I forget. Was there a reason why they didn't just get back in the car?
He rounds to a phone booth. Yeah. They, for some reason, walk.
Yeah.
But then they become six out of nowhere. Like out of the darkness, they come.
Well, this is what's part of what's really good about this movie too, is because the gang slowly gets bigger and bigger as it gets.
Well, they
goes
become
on.
A force. They're not
yeah,
people.
Exactly. That's right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So Lawson then eventually comes across the precinct by luck, and he goes in, and that's when he kind of breaks down. And
he
then
subscribes
and
to
can't
the
talk.
Over the top is not over the top enough. Cool.
Okay, so then the transport officer is on the phone at this point when he's suddenly cut off, and then the power goes out.
Mm-hmm.
We have Officer Cheney, who's like the only, I guess, beat officer that's there. Outside
the desk officer.
Yeah, it's a desk officer. That's it. So he goes to call a fellow precinct using the comms in his car, but in doing so, he gets shot and killed.
Yeah. And they go, oh, he's tripped.
He's tripped. Oh, that Cheney. What a cunt. He's done the... Hey, Julie, he's done the falling over again.
he's doing the bleeding out of the back.
Oh, dear.
But it is interesting because before they actually realise that there's a danger present, they just stay behind the doors. Like, wouldn't you open the door and just say, oh, you're all right, mate?
That's right.
They all stay.
Stay, mind. That's
they,
it.
They prefer to look through this little window. It's just That's it.
So at the same time, the prison transport guys who are getting transported back onto the bus suddenly get ambushed. They basically kill every officer standing, and I think the sick prisoner
gets killed.
And then it's just Wilson and Wells that are left, and they kind of scramble themselves back in. Mm. I think Bishop starts, helps them, but he locks them back up again.
Yes.
Two prisoners are still safe. Gunfire just kind of howls down on them as they kind of duck and cover. And then we're kind of just left with... other than the prisoners, there's Bishop, Lee and Julia, the sole survivors of the department. The father is still alive too.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got... Six people.
Is he just completely stricken with grief or...
Yeah, he's just gone.
He's just incapacitated.
He's catatonic.
I did think that at one point.
Yeah.
Later on, I wondered, there's another round of gunfire and I thought he was dead.
Maybe.
But he wasn't.
He does not move.
No, that's right.
He's just entombed.
That's it.
A mummy.
Yeah.
So eventually the gunfire ceases and the survivors try to take stock of the situation. And I think Bishop says the lines, "We're in the middle of the city, inside the police station." As in, like, you know, we're supposed to be in the safest place ever, and it's not.
Not very safe.
And then Bishop looks out the station, and he sees a lot of movement, and this is where we do see the extent of the number of the gang. Like, they just start coming out of the darkness.
Yeah.
Awesome moment.
Because they coordinated, because they called each other on their mobiles.
Yeah, that's it. That's how they did it. Yeah. Hey, I got a fax here.
Have I got a phone? That's still a beep.
Yeah. Siege at Precinct 13.
What's that?
Turned up, Precinct 9, yeah.
There isn't that. Like, half of them turned up to Precinct 13.
That's the wrong one. At this point, the three remaining warlords come out. They throw some blood on the floor and drape a sheet with some writing on the ground, and we later learn that this is known as the Cholo.
But they throw the blood on the ground, they put the sheet, it's too windy,
yeah,
and the sheet is going to blow away. Cut to a close-up on another day when it's not so windy. Because I didn't think that through. Because that's the sort of thing, if you want to make a like a dramatic statement, like throw a sheet on the ground, you just know that it's going to be a windy day.
Yeah, of course.
Just totally undermine what you want to do.
Quick, get Chaney, pin him down on that corner, stick him there.
Have you got four rocks?
You stand on there.
Four, you got four rocks? Yeah, that's right, bitch.
Yeah, Cholo, you.
Yeah. And they walk back.
They do, and then they walk back, calmly. Basically, this means they've been marked, and we're now in a facing a siege situation. And we have the Julie character saying about the father, "Here's the one they want."
There's always one.
just throw him to the wolves.
There's always one that says, "If you betray Robin Hood, then the Sheriff of Nottingham won't tax us."
Yeah, that's it. She says that word for word. And obviously Bishop's the one that stands for them all, high ground, and says, "No, we're here to protect." Yep. So the gang then outside start pushing the cars forward and they start firing again. So they're using the parked cars across the street as barriers. Lee goes and releases the prisoners just as the gang start breaking into the back, and Wilson protects her.
She gets shot in the arm.
Yeah.
Doesn't even flinch.
She doesn't flinch a lot.
She's completely cold, like a freaking robot. To the point where, is this the twist where we reveal she's a vampire or something? Because she gets shot right through the arm and goes, "Not gonna cry. Yeah. Not gonna say anything.
Yeah, fuck you."
And they keep coming.
Cholo your ass.
Yeah. Cholo this.
Yeah. Anyway. I'm just thinking of. Is it Spitz or Cholo? Come on. So they had. They've been. So as I said. Lee kind of breaks out Wilson and Wells. Bishop finally gets some arsenal and hands it to Wilson, who starts blowing away some of the members as they break in.
That's the box.
That's the box. Finally gets it open.
He pulls. What does he do? He just rips it open.
He just tries harder.
Yeah. Polio did that before.
Padlock. I thought he was going to. Did he use the gun to?
I can't remember. I think he just. But anyway, here's the load of chocolate.
It's like opening a jar. Like, it was loosened before.
Yeah. Lee goes, "I loosened that for you. That's the reason why."
It is a pretty cool... It's a cool moment, though.
It is, you
know, the gun toss.
That's it. And automatically...
Oh, it was very choreographed, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's great. And that's very iconic of Westerns, too. Remembering homages to Rio Bravo here. And it's all about defence now, as we see Wilson happily offing people left, right and centre. We have Bishop and Lee also defending themselves and as the gang keeps advancing.
Bishop uses a rifle.
He does, yeah.
Deer rifle. But they keep coming.
They do.
They're like a fucking zombie horde.
Yeah. I wonder how many extras... Like,
one was John Carpenter.
I was going to say, like, the same group of extras getting killed.
But my first thought was, like, they're just, again, not realising that he's symbolically going for zombies here. But, like, why do you keep running down a corridor when you've seen there's 15 of you already dead? Maybe as a 16th guy, you probably go, maybe I won't do this? Because clearly that's a death trap. But they keep coming! They keep getting shot.
I think they're just suicidal. And
that's it.
They figure they'll run out of bullets eventually.
Well, do you want to go first, Dan? Just in case, you know.
I'll be alright. You'll be alright.
Yeah, you go first, Dan. Oh, okay. Long
time.
Fine. So,
okay, I realise that Ant and Ben's dead, but let's keep going. But it's a Cholo. And then we get a bit more insight into that in a sec. So, eventually, the onslaught does stop. This is when they start to board themselves up, barricading themselves in as much as they can. They discover some bottles of flammable gas. Might come in handy later on. And we also, when they look out the window, they see that the gang have then put all the cars back, removed all the bodies, and hidden any evidence of the carnage that took place.
Took all the shells.
Picked
that shit up. Just got the chemicals out. Scrubbing, no blood.
The blood on the
ground. So the idea is that if anyone passes by, it'll just look like nothing's happened.
And they use silencers. And nobody heard anything.
That's it.
Which is bullshit.
Oh, come on.
Just YouTube silences on and any gun, it's very loud.
It goes like this. Come on. We then learn through Wells that Cholo means that the gang don't care and will rip us apart no matter what the cost, to the death.
Mm-hmm.
Wells threatens to make a run for it, but is convinced round.
That's right, because he has a gun, a revolver with a silencer, which again can't work.
Yeah.
And he realizes, oh no, I was shooting no bullets, but because it was on silent, I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
It's like, I love that silences! Bit.
I had no idea!
I had no idea I wasn't shooting bullets.
You mean you didn't kill anyone, you swat. Okay.
That was a bad shot.
So the times are desperate and ammunition is low,
yes.
Even the silent ones. A police car drives by and takes a sweep around the neighbourhood. One of the cops looks a bit like Ben Stiller, I wrote.
Oh,
it's not him. It's not him, but I kind of went, Zoolander?
Before, before reality bites.
Yeah, so, that's it. Yeah.
I don't know,
it could be just me because I'm a bit like that, but there you go. They decide to ignore the street where the precinct is on and drive past. At the precinct, the guys come up with a plan to get to a car, hotwire it, and make a break for it. Well, Bishop can't do it because he's doesn't know how to hotwire a car. He's a cop. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Lee's got one arm. She's been shot in the arm.
Yeah.
And so it's down to the convicts. And how do they resolve it? They play potatoes.
Taters. What is that?
No idea.
So much... Apparently,
I still didn't get it when I watched it. I was like, what?
What is that? It's so,
how do you know who won?
That's a game of skill as opposed to, like, scissors, papers, rock, because, you know, purely a game of luck.
I don't know what it is.
I keep saying he's got terrible luck.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, you're going to die. Like, it's inevitable.
That's it. Okay.
Take you out of the movie for like a second.
I just thought that bit was hilarious. Yeah. So Wells gets the short straw, and he's the one that goes to make the run for the car. Wells climbs out of the manhole, hotwires the car, starts to drive away, and just when it looks like he's in the clear, a gang member pops up from behind the back seat and shoots him.
Because that gang member said, of all the cars he's going to steal, it's going to be this one.
Yeah. There's lots of cars out there, and each one had a gang member in the back. Just in case.
Can you imagine what the car he didn't hop in going, well, this is fucked. Like, I'm just waiting around for nothing.
Yeah.
Like, at least Jeff had to kill the guy.
Yeah, that's it.
He shoots him, his head goes out the window, and Bishop from, like, way back. Yeah. So, well, maybe his head just fell out the window. That could have been anything.
He's all right.
He's fine.
Yeah, sure, the car's on fire, but he's all right. Okay, so then now this is where the gang start coming out in droves for the final ambush. The three survivors grab the father.
Because Julie was killed, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah, totally missed that. How did I miss that? Totally missed that. Julie's dead. Oh yeah, that was after the first onslaught. So before they decide they need to do something and make a run for it. Yeah, Julie gets killed.
They put her body next to Julie's.
How do I miss that?
So catatonic.
Yeah,
he's dead too.
Yeah.
But he's not.
Thanks for picking that up.
I didn't realize until the very end that he was still alive. So,
let's drag his body down.
He's dead. Oh. So the three survivors grab him, and they go down and basically hole up in the basement and wait for the onslaught to come. And this is where, you know, we're all out of time, and then Wilson goes, I was born out of time.
Got a smoke.
And then Bishop sets up the gas tank from earlier and basically if they're going to go out, they're going to go out with a bang. Again, we cut to outside. Police car does a drive-by from the same police car from before, and that's where they discover a telephone maintenance man from the village people.
Yes.
He's been shot and killed. And he's hanging dead from the phone lines. They call for emergency backup. And at this point, at the same time, the gang starts breaking into the precinct. And this is the point where Bishop asks Wilson, how did you become Napoleon Wilson? And he says, I'll tell you sometime. And they defend themselves basically with an inch of their lives. We've got Lee killing people who are trying to climb through the vent, which is where Wells escaped to get out through the manhole. Mm-hmm. And then the last shot that Bishop has just happens to hit the tank. There's an explosion and smoke goes everywhere. And then at this point, the reinforcements arrive and the gang disbands. The smoke clears and officers start walking over the dead bodies. And they find our three survivors holding whatever they had to hand, waiting to defend themselves. And Wilson says, anyone got a smoke? Again. The father gets carried out on a stretcher. He's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get, like you were saying earlier, the point where they go to offer Lee a stretcher because she's been shot in the arm, and she chooses to walk out, and we leave the two guys on their own.
Yeah.
Which, can I just add, white man, black man, ending survivors, the thing.
Yes.
White man, black man, survivors at the end too, just as a recurring theme.
Yeah.
And so...
No women.
No women. No women.
That's the thing.
That's it. Yeah, can't have any women. Wilson and Bishop are left there. A cop goes to handcuff Wilson, and Bishop pushes them aside, and then basically turns to Wilson and says, "It would be a privilege if you'd walk outside with me." And Wilson says, "I know it would." And they walk out side by side, yes, up this very narrow stairwell, yes, side by side, as equals. Close credits.
Is there another one? I remember there being a one. I don't know. You're pretty fancy, Wilson.
Oh, yeah, there's an extension to that, yeah.
And that's it's just kind of a... Yeah, I mean it's... They're two badass characters, and they're just...
Yeah.
They don't have to make sense.
It doesn't at all. Doesn't at all. So, before we talk about our final verdicts on it, what was your instincts on watching it? Was this was your first time you watched it?
First time I'd seen it.
So you had seen the remake, though.
Because I first heard about Precinct 13 when the remake was coming out, and you were like bouncing off the walls, going, "Oh, it's a remake! It's a remake!" I'm like, "What are you doing?" Well, I got you to calm down. You told me I saw the Precinct 13 is one of my seminal films. I loved it. It's John Carpenter.
Yeah.
Like, and I was, I had no idea. Didn't know what it's about. Sounds like a really groovy idea.
Yeah.
Saw the remake. I'm like, but never saw the original. Same thing with The Fog. Like, because you were like, when The Fog remake came out, you bounced off.
Fucking had Superman in there.
And you talk about The Fog, this is a John Carpenter film, it's a seminal film, it's my favorite thing ever. Then I saw the remake, so, then I saw the original, I'm gonna need to see the remake again. So my thought was I kind of get now why the remake was what it was, because the remake
The
Fog extends the storyline a little bit. And Assault on Precinct 13, the remake, is so much more complicated plot wise.
Absolutely.
Than this film. I was like, I couldn't get over the bad acting.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly like one takes. Because they had a lot of moments, particularly from the lead, where they're pausing at the middle of a sentence because I'm trying to remember the rest of my life. There's about four of those moments. But I do appreciate that this was guerrilla filmmaking at its finest. And I can understand why it was a seminal film.
Because
thinking about it in context, I'm like, okay, this is a student film that's done really, really well.
Yeah.
So, and I can understand why. It's like The Thing. When I saw The Thing as a kid, I will hear nothing against it. I think it's a brilliant film. But I do, when I step back, realize, nothing really happens for quite a while. And it's a slow-paced film.
What's wrong with that?
I know, but
I get so tired of that.
It's so indicative of the time.
Yeah, totally.
It's just, they just didn't rush to anything, they had time to breathe.
And by doing that, you get to know the characters a lot more. And yes, you could argue that the characters are a bit weak in this one, but like, that's...
There's actually not that... as you've just pointed out, like, there's just not that much plot here.
No.
But if you see it at a certain age, it becomes DNA.
Yeah.
So this film clearly is for you.
Completely. There's so much I loved about this movie. And I was... I'm so glad that we're talking about Carpenter now, because, like, for me, he's like that, and particularly this period as well. I just love his work.
He's so. I don't think I realized how influential he was until I started hearing other directors talk about, like, everyone, Edgar Wright, like Tarantino. He made Tarantino made this is obviously not this is a different film, but obviously the cast of The Hateful Eight rewatched The Thing before they made The Hateful Eight.
Obviously
they're stuck in a cabin.
Right.
Very, very claustrophobic.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Okay, really?
So even Tarantino, who's actually not that, they're not too far apart, like, age-wise, but, he obviously watched that movie a lot, or his movies a lot, when he was working in the video store.
Will
Gibson apparently mentioned that scene when Kim Richards getting shot, and that helped spark interest in the film. A lot of people love it.
I think it's because he's, like, genre-wise, he kind of covered so many different things. Like, it wasn't specifically, like, horror. He wasn't specifically crime or specifically, like, thriller. Mm. Like, you got the feeling like he had a grasp just on filmmaking in general.
Yeah.
So, look, I get it. I get why people, why it was a similar
thing. Just on the music thing too, like Robert Rodriguez, again, part of the whole Tarantino factor. Pretty sure he got, I'll have to look this up to confirm it, but I'm pretty sure he got Compton to do some of the music for Planet Terror, which was part of the Grindhouse stuff. So, as you said, a lot of people were heavily influenced by Compton's work.
The music for Attack the Block is
Very
much a throwback.
That's right.
That's a good film. But I can see how Precinct couldn't have been that sort of film.
Yeah. See, there's certain things about it. To me, I don't know. I don't know whether I fall into the trap of nostalgia with these kind of films, though. Mm. But for me, like, this whole period is just, I love watching them over and over. I could just keep watching them. And we're talking about, so there's not a lot of plot. Yeah, sure, the acting's not great, and the dialogue is sparse, but I think the sparsity is part of the beauty of this film, in the sense that there are these kind of long, kind of drawn-out passages, which
it's really...
kind of,
the dialogue's not really important. Like, you'd watch the movie without the sound on, and...
You could.
Especially some of those waves of attacks, like, there's some pretty fast cutting going on there,
yeah,
and it's really well put together, like, you're not really confused... at all, like, the visual storytelling kind of makes sense, and...
That's it.
Yeah, I think that's the real strength.
I mean, conceptually, for me, too, like, Siege films are great.
Yeah.
The Siege, as a concept, is stems all the way back to having a pillow fort as a kid. To me, and that's a very... I think that's a thing that resonates with a lot of people. And Siege films tend to be fantastic from that point.
And a massive Western... I mean, I can keep talking about the Western thing, but it's...
Well, I didn't even know about the West. I just assumed, watching it, I picked up on that straight away.
I didn't
do any kind of research into it, but I think it is. And even the way that they're, like, they run around... Actually, they more remind me of ninjas when they're just, like... they're completely silent when they're...
Yeah,
outside, and there's just more of them, like, appearing. And
yeah.
Well, they're quite faceless. You don't really clock their faces.
No.
Which is the whole Stormtrooper thing, like, Star Wars. The Stormtroopers can identify them.
That's right.
The fact they weren't just a mindless horde. It's like, oh, okay. So they're forced.
But some of the best movies are, like, disguised as a different genre. Mm. Like, you know, a Western disguised as a modern day.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
It's a modern day.
That's right.
Well, Aliens was supposed to be a Vietnam War movie. Some people have put drawn this.
Well, I can see that. Very easily.
Anyway, go.
Yeah, no, cool. All right, well, let's start looking at the players of the piece, the core actors that are in it. Got Austin Stoker, as we mentioned, who plays Ethan Bishop. Outside of this, he played the role of McDonald in Battle for the Planet of the Apes, part of the original franchise. Mm-hmm. As well as Jeff Allen in the series of the series Return to the Planet of the Apes 2. He was also in Horror High, Airport 1975, and he would also appear alongside his co-star Darwin Jostin as Dr. Ken Melrose in the 1982 B-movie Time Walker, which I wouldn't expect you to know that movie. I'm purely mentioning it because he teams up with Darwin again. Thoughts on him, lead actor, as we mentioned, very importantly playing against what would be known as the hero type then, having an African-American law enforcer who's, the one that's defending the cause.
Yeah.
He's just a likable guy. Like, he's just a nice guy.
He's a pretty straight shooter.
Yeah.
There's not much edge to him.
Yeah.
But he kind of needed to be that because when he teams up with
Wilson. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, he's the straight man to Wilson's.
Wilson's the cool guy.
Who played it in the remake?
Ethan Hawke and Larry Fishburne.
So they swapped the roles around.
And
Ethan Hawke is very good as he was a greener cop. He was more of an idealist. I kind of got the impression this guy had been around the block a few times. He's just fighting the book.
As an aside, I watched Regression this week. Have you seen that, Ethan Hawke?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of that?
Emma Watson.
He does a lot of okay.
Yeah.
I came out of it going, oh,
yeah.
There you go.
He's often better than the film around him a lot of the time.
What was the one he did in Australia?
The film, Day of Night, or whatever.
He did Predestination here, and he did
Daybreakers. With the Spirit Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he did the one that's a time travel one, and I'm pretty sure
Predestination.
Yeah, and that actress is Australian.
Cool.
And that was okay.
So, but the thing is with that, I was hoping there that we were going to keep on track because it was short. But on my last thing on that Regression of Ethan Hawke, I should say, is in particular in that movie, if he wasn't playing that role, I would have tuned out way before. To me, there was something odd about him, which kept me watching it. Anyway,
okay.
Darwin Jostin, who plays Napoleon Wilson. This was his most noted role, but he did surface as Paul in, not me, in David Lynch's Eraserhead. He would crop up again in John Carpenter in The Fog, playing a role of the mortician called Dr. Phoebes, which is another nod to another horror film which Vincent Price was in, okay. The abominable Dr. Phoebes. Carpenter has said that he wrote the Napoleon Wilson role with Justin in mind and imbued the character with some of Justin's personality traits. It seems that when Carpenter was writing the screenplay for Assault and Precinct 13, he and Justin both lived in the same Hollywood Hills apartment building, and they became friends. Mm-hmm. So hence why that would infuse in your writing of the script. Having gotten to know Justin and his dark sense of humour, Carpenter felt that his neighbour would make an interesting anti-hero. Some, including Quentin Tarantino, consider Justin to have been a vastly underrated actor whose talent was not duly recognised during his lifetime.
Is he passed on?
Yeah, he's passed on.
Oh.
Yeah,
which probably means that Tarantino would have used him.
Yeah, like, that's true. Oh, yeah.
Now
yeah.
He's still around, he would have found a way to use him.
Point. Yeah, yeah. So, what do we think of
it? It reminds me of a guy that you work with called Jesse.
He just walked past the recording booth we're in right now.
He did. So, he is a guy that I work, the better I work with. He reminds me an awful lot. If Jesse went off the rails, we can't.
Is that because he's always asking for a smoke?
I think that's what it is. Nice. It's just very laconic. And
hey, Jesse, yeah. if you're listening,
no, hey, Jess.
We say this in a loving way.
I, as I said earlier, to me, this character is the prototype to Snake.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much around that comes later on. Obviously, Snake is a lot more formed as a character. And Kurt brings Kurt to it. So, but that's no disrespect to the actor. He is. I haven't seen Rio Bravo, but is he the John Wayne character?
No.
Or is John Wayne the sheriff character?
John Wayne's the sheriff character. Okay. Dean Martin's probably the closest to him, because Dean Martin.
Okay.
But Dean Martin was a fallen hero.
Okay.
And you have your third one is Ricky Martin.
Ricky Martin. Living the vida loca.
But he was a pop singer back in the day, because my mum.
Ricky Valens.
Ricky Valens. Okay,
was he in that?
Okay. Yeah, he was
say La Bamba guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Not La Bamba guy. Ricky something else. But anyway, he was a pop singer.
And Little Richard.
Those roles. And there's two songs in Rio Bravo which are quite good. So Paul's going to play them as cutaways right now.
You're the synth guy.
The thing about Rio Bravo, can I just say real quick?
Yeah,
of course. Because the line, Have You Got a Smoke, was Dean Martin's line. That's why he made it into the movie.
Okay.
But when I first saw Rio Bravo, I was like, you should play a drinking game. If you see Rio Bravo, play a drinking game. Every time somebody puts a rifle down and then picks it up a second later, take a shot, you'll be hammered.
why would they put a rifle
down? Every scene they come in, John Wayne, particularly John Wayne, puts his rifle down. He comes in from outside, puts his rifle down, and he realizes he's got to go somewhere else, and he picks up his rifle and walks out again.
Is it more just, they've been carrying the rifle, they just need to flex their hands a bit, warm the muscles up,
pick it back again. But it's just, it happens a dozen times in the movie.
We did say that Ant has an attention to detail of these things.
Irrelevant things.
I really like his character in this. I know it's a bit two dimensional to say the least, but there is something about this. And as I said, to me, I feel like it's the bones of what will come later down the track.
Yeah, sure.
Moving forward, we've got Laurie Zimmer, who plays Lee.
I liked her. But originally she comes across as like really, I think she's a model who's trying her hand at acting. Yeah. She's so dead straight.
Yeah.
But because she keeps that consistency up and she's quite level-headed, she gets shot in the arm and doesn't even blink. she's quite light and she plays off against these two. Like when another guy starts hysterically going, what do we do? And she's the one who's keeping her head.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if that was I don't know if that was intentional or if that's just her, like...
Maybe she has no other way to go.
She's got a I-don't-give-a-fuck attitude, which is cool for the character, but...
Definitely.
She might be like that in every movie.
Well, here's the thing. My first was like, how come I've never heard of this girl?
Yeah.
Because I was like, based on that, she's worthy of trying out a few things.
Yeah.
Then she basically disappeared to the point where somebody made a documentary about
her. Yeah, that's right.
Saying, where is Laurie...
Where is Laurie Zimmer? And that's exactly right.
It was done in 2009.
Yeah.
And the whole premise was, at the beginning of the doc, she had no idea. She was a friend of hers.
Right.
And she had no idea where she went. So she was asking, including John Carpenter, she asked, where the hell is she? And she drove him down the neighborhood she was last seen with a big sign on the back of her truck. Have you seen Laurie Zimmer? Call this number now.
Yeah.
And the film does conclude with she does find her. And she's retired or...
I think she's a teacher or something.
Teacher or something, yeah.
No, you're right. Like, it is an odd one because you're right. Off the back, arguably, we don't know. I've not seen the other movies. She was in three other films, okay, firstly. And I'll tell them in a minute. But outside of that, she just dropped off the face of the earth, okay? So we're kind of really only judging her on this one movie. Yes, it's a really cool character. Yes, she does it well. But is she just, like Ben said, is she just being herself in it? It's hard to know. Exactly, we haven't got another platform to judge her on. Off the back of that, you would expect her to get a lot more work and, you know, and something come out of it because it was such a... It is such a cool character.
The films from this era, you'd imagine it's just the ditzy, like, you know, heroin and trouble.
That's it. It's such a cool character. It really is a good character in it. And I like the fact that she's really level-headed and I guess, the ditzy one gets killed.
Yeah.
Which normally these days is the other way around. The more intelligent you are, the more likely you are going to get killed. Yeah. So the other three titles she was in was a film called American Raspberry and a couple of other ones. There was Dirty Story and Survival of Dana. Wouldn't even reach your radar, really. As you said, she did turn up in 2003 with a documentary based around her called Do You Remember Laurie Zimmer? The film kind of chronicles the ladies, Slovak, I think her name was, search to discover why Zimmer quit acting, where she is now and what she's doing. And it reveals that she lives near San Francisco, works as a teacher and is married to actor Bruce Still, has two sons, one of them is a musician, Julian Still, of the band The KO Brothers, and the other one's a performance artist called Max Steel.
There you go.
And that was the conclusion. Yeah, didn't do anything outside of that, which... to me, might be something sadly missing and could have been something we've missed out on in film industry. But
true.
Yeah.
But I do have respect for people who get into acting and do get exposed to the high end of it and go, you know what?
Yeah, not for me.
I'd rather be a doctor. Don't. Thank you.
Yeah, fuck yous.
Fair enough.
Cholos on your ass.
Yeah.
Then quickly we'll go through a couple of the other people. Martin West played the father character Lawson. Other than this, he was probably known for playing Dr. Phil Brewer in General Hospital on TV series. He was also played a character called Sanger in Hitchcock's Family Plot. I'm going to just skip along that. That's all I need to say about him.
Other than his daughter dies.
Does a comatose.
Yeah. He puts his jacket over straight away.
She's dead, man.
I mean, it's one of those. Well, I mean, I guess nobody could say if the child gets killed, what would you do?
He's
got vengeance on his mind, though, at the time.
That I understood.
Fury to the max.
He doesn't really try too hard, does he? I guess it's pretty obvious she's dead.
Yeah.
But still, wouldn't you be in denial for at least a little longer?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah,
I think it was the vanilla swirl that brought him back, into perspective.
Oh, is that what he was really upset about?
Yeah.
That's
a scoop!
That killed Kim Richards. It was a paintball that was exploded.
Yeah. And we will get to her. I know you really want to talk about
Kim Richards.
Yeah, she's a housewife now.
We haven't got to her yet.
Sorry,
God damn it. So the other person is Tony Burton, who plays Wells, the other prison convict. Now, he's really known, or most known, as playing the corner man Duke in the 6 Rocky movies.
Yes, that's who he is.
I thought I knew him.
So, that's him. And he was Larry Durkin, also in The Shining, as another horror ripple. Burton, actually, a bit of background on him. He wound up in prison and he doing like 3.5 years for robbery. This was before he got into acting. And he did a workshop in the prison that used psychodrama, which is a form of therapy. By the way, I've studied drama, and this is one of my areas that I really, really love, psychodrama. I think it's a really, really cool way of kind of working on...
I've seen Paul put actors through psychodrama. It's not
Chad in particular did it.
Chad was like,
we're going to do it again.
And Chad was just looking at me, give me out of here. I'm trapped like you are.
Anyway, so look, all this would point Burton towards his acting career when an emotional breakthrough achieved by one of his partners in the acting exercise dramatically demonstrated theatre's potential power. And he got into acting after that. I don't know what else to say about him. He's kind of like, he's there.
He's there.
He's the token support role for...
Is there
for,
body count? Because somebody's got to die in a plan.
Yeah, but
it's one plan.
But importantly, like, I think you need that other prison convict to support the Wilson character. So someone who knows his past that comes with him and is talking about his past as they go with him.
Right, yeah.
So that's kind of his role there. We also have Charles Cyphers, who plays Starker. So he's the prison transport officer.
Yeah, you recognise his face.
Okay, so he would go on to play Sheriff Lee Brackett in Halloween and Halloween 2. Mm-hmm. He would also crop up in a couple of other Carpenter films, Someone's Watching Me, Elvis. He played Dan O'Bannon in The Fog, and he also played the Secretary of State in Escape from New York.
Cups
up quite a few times. Outside of Carpenter World, he also was play a character called Pee-wee in Coming Home, not Pee-wee's Adventures, completely different person. He would play Donald Kay in Death Wish 2, Captain Lader in Hill Street Blues, which was what really a lot of TV viewers of the 80s would probably know him more so from. He cropped up in an episode of Freddy's Nightmares. Charlie played the role of Charlie Donovan in Major League. And also...
That's him. He's the coach, isn't he?
I don't know. Is that the coach?
No. He's the one that tells the boss that he blows a raspberry at the boss.
Yeah.
Because he's the offsider. He's trying to root for the team.
That's it. Yeah, thank you. I was like, I couldn't picture who he was from it.
Shut up. Sit down.
And he also played Coach Carl Marin in the film version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I couldn't bring myself to watch the Buffy film. I still haven't. I don't think I ever will.
I always thought that the Buffy film Buffy Girl should have met Sarah Michelle Gellar in the TV series as an alternate universe thing.
Ooh.
And I've met Joss Whedon once and I forgot to pitch that to him as an idea.
Well, he's not in his control.
Yeah, that's true.
They're having a new movie, aren't they? Oh, is it a movie or TV series?
There's a new TV series. No, movie.
It's a movie.
It's a new movie, but it got shot down.
Oh, is it?
Well, it's continued.
No, it's still happening.
It's continued on in the comics for years now.
The comics is continuing on as series 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
But the movie, as far as I knew, was in development hell, so maybe.
Ah, okay, maybe it has. Maybe it's gone. Okay, moving on. We have Nancy Keys, aka Nancy Loomis, who plays Julie. She would go on to play Annie Brackett in Halloween, basically the babysitter character.
Oh, right, okay.
She would also play Sandy Fidel in The Fog. Lindy Chalice in Halloween 3, The Season of the Witch, which actually at that time March was the only actor / actress to have appeared in 3 Halloween movies. She was married to director Tommy Lee Wallace, who actually would go on to direct parts 2 and 3 of the Halloween franchise. Again, not really much to say about her in this one.
The weak one. There's always going to be one who's going to go to say out loud what everybody's thinking. So yeah, she was the weak one.
She's the weak one, that's right. We have Harry Brandon, who plays Chaney. He was, he's been in a lot of films, mainly around the 30s and 40s. He cropped up in a Lauren Hardy film early on. He would play Dr. Fu Manchu in Drums of Fu Manchu. Sorry, Anne.
Weirdly enough, I'm not
sorry. Tarzan and the She-Devil. He was in The War of the Worlds, played Captain Danette in Vera Cruz, and also Scar in The Searchers. Which is probably why he got cast in this.
As a nod to another
John Wayne film.
Let's
move on to Kim Richards, played Kathy. Various family movies, and also played Olga Nordstrom in Little House on the Prairie. And, you know, as you mentioned, Escape to Witch Mountain and Return to the Witch Mountain as Tia Malone. More recently known from reality series Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Isn't
she
the aunt of some famous... not biological, but Britney Spears or something like that.
I don't know. I didn't know that. She's been in various TV roles since. Maybe
loved her. She
small
was in
roles, really.
Different but, Strokes for a while as the neighbor or something.
Oh right. I think I know the one. I remember the yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, she would play Christina Ricci's estranged mother in Black Snake Moan.
Back to our childhood crushes.
Yeah.
Bunch of creeps.
Yeah.
Apparently, Carpenter would almost stalk Richards in order to get her in the role of Kathy. Carpenter was asked to... on that, the reason he did that is because she was so iconic with the Disney thing and have her shot. He really wanted that kind of innocence.
Yeah, blown away.
Yeah.
Did that attract her to the role? She's like, yes, finally get
you. I don't know. Like, he kept... I don't know why she said yes, but he kept trying to get her. There was a lot of no, and eventually he got her. Interestingly, on that particular scene where she does die, Carpenter was asked to cut it back and edit Kathy's death scene in order to reduce the rating of the movie, which he did, but he sent the original print to the cinemas anyway.
And then after that, the classification board goes, you know what, let's make a rule that that doesn't happen again.
Yeah. I mean, everyone would do that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everyone would fucking do it.
Oh, I sent the wrong one.
And I was like, Paul, yeah. You get a gun. Are you going to shoot me? No. Yes. Are you sure you're not going to shoot me?
No.
Okay. Well, in that case, you can come in.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, you shot me.
Yeah.
So look, it was a really impactful moment in the film.
Did he cut it entirely or? I guess
you just saw the gunshot and but you didn't see her. None of the impact of
physical.
Yeah. Anyway, and then the last person I want to talk about is Frank Doubleday, who plays the White Warlord. And the reason I say that is because he would crop up again in Carpenter film as Romero in Escape from New York.
Oh, okay.
So he's the white punk dude, essentially.
He's a generic
white guy who goes to...
He was relatively, like, yeah, you know...
Oh, the four warlords was the one who was... doing stuff.
Because he got more screen time.
And we will talk about his role in Escape from New York down the track, because there's an important thing about that that's been a nod from another fellow actor.
Oh, okay.
And but we'll talk about that down the track, as we said. It's all connected.
It is with Carpenter.
Now, let's look at Carpenter, the director's note, okay? Obviously, he wrote it, directed it, did the music for it, okay? Following Dark Star. Carpenter, as I said, was eager to make a Western, but lacked the money to do so. So he loosely adapted Howard Hawks' film Rio Bravo and set it on the streets of LA instead. Do you want to talk about that in particular? Like we were talking earlier on about watching Rio Bravo and
Rio Bravo, the only connection I have was the big gun battle at the end there, which was a siege. But they were on the outside trying to get in.
Yeah, yeah.
And killing a bunch of bad guys.
You mean the good guys were?
Yeah, the good guys were.
Yep.
Yeah, so is it worth listeners seeking out, or...?
Rio Bravo is a seminal Western film. It is very much. It's kind of, it breaks into a musical number. They sing songs because the Vicky dude was a pop singer, and Dean Martin can sing as well. And songs themselves are actually not bad.
It's not like paint my wagon.
It's not.
It is one of those things where, like, you can sing this, but it is kind of weird how it happens, and then they get back into the actual film. But it's a classic film of its era where nothing happens. Literally, they walk into a room, put down a gun, talk, realise maybe we should go back outside and pick up a gun. That happens like six times.
Here's my thing, right? Mm. And I know this isn't a John Ford film, but he has... Is he still the most Academy Award-winning director?
Western director ever.
Anyway, he's won a whole lot of shit for his stuff, right? And Ant will recognise what I'm saying in this. For me, Westerns is how you are with gangster films.
Yeah.
Right? So I just find them boring as batshit, right? There are exceptions. Don't get me wrong, there are exceptions.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
The spaghetti westerns, I love. I absolutely love the spaghetti westerns.
Most people love the spaghetti westerns, and then they go and try and watch more, and they're just like...
It's like killing out. I went through this thing where I wanted, because there was like the top 100 Empire films of all time. I'm going to churn through that stuff. I'm going to watch them all. Yeah. And I always found the Western ones really, really fucking painful to watch. I was like, oh my God, seriously? I really like High Noon, though, going back to like a really old school film. But
What do you think of Tombstone and the Wide Open? That's
funny. Why? Tombstone's only good purely for, not me. I consider myself to be in my prime. the rest of it you can just take with a pinch of salt.
Tombstone is a classic example of, like, which Val Kilmer am I dealing with here?
That is
Val Kilmer 211. That's such a good film. But on either side of it, you're like, what the fuck?
I get those two films confused, though.
With the Wide Open?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they came out at the same time. Yeah,
they did. Yeah. That was a classic parallel. Panics and goes into like they're doing the gunfight at AK Corral. We'll do one.
Isn't one of them? Didn't they have a massive amount of cuts? And there's like a director's cut out there somewhere.
The Kurt Russell one he effectively directed, because the director they had wasn't that experienced. And apparently, this is what happens, that Kurt Russell does direct, and you don't mind as much because he actually really knows what the fuck he's doing.
Mm. Well, it's been in the industry enough to know.
Apparently, another rumor is. London's form. What's his name?
Jared Butler.
Apparently,
just going to call him Gordon.
Very much like that as well. On set, he starts directing.
All right.
And they start.
I don't know about him.
Yeah, but apparently they're saying that that's his next logical step. He's one of those like Denzel Washington's.
Interesting to see how he.
I can't really see Jared Butler. Like,
Yet again, actors who know how to shoot themselves in a scene and they know how to construct
close-ups.
But they realise, like Stallone, have you ever seen Stallone direct himself? It actually is quite of an eye-opening experience, because when he does The Expendables, he has his shorthand language, he knows how to shoot, where to shoot, how to shoot me, how to shoot him, how to shoot me, and he'll say it in character on set. And it's just the science of way of directing yourself is really interesting.
Interesting.
Kurt Russell, but the whole scene with the guy, he stares down the guy, he's not armed. That was all him.
Yeah,
yeah. How he's going to approach that. And how would he scare? How the hell would he intimidate a guy who's armed with a gun? He's not.
Mm.
And this is how you do it. Anyway.
I could hear you talk about that for ages, buddy, but we're crunching out of time. So, just going back to Carpenter. So, essentially, the film is essentially a siege mentality. It's got that siege mentality. And it's clear in the fact that it uses the faceless mob that you were talking about as well as the attackers. And this is a concept that Carpenter would often use, as in a small group defending themselves from an unknown assailant. There are echoes, as I said, of the Night of the Living Dead in the sense, plus the use of the African-American actor as the lead. The film itself would gain more success overseas, primarily in Britain, but it would pave the way for many more films to come. What was your final verdict, would you say, on...
I think the history of the film interested me. The fact that it was a hit overseas.
Massive Britain. Maybe that's why I remember it so...
Yeah, right.
I mean, it wasn't...
How old were you when you saw it?
See, I wasn't alive when it came out, because it's 76. I was like, oh, this looks good.
Mum.
Worst parents.
Man, I don't know, this is where when I start talking to Miles, we're on a similar wavelength. Yeah. We're both from Britain, we both basically watched a lot of stuff from video rentals.
Right.
And I don't know how old I would have been, maybe 9 or 10, maybe, right. I don't know, I was young. But a lot of those movies I watched around then,
far too young.
Yeah.
But, well, it's you're right. I'd say you were old enough in your own
hasn't mind. Shaped me at all.
Yeah. It's only the ones that scar you where you're like, I probably shouldn't have watched that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything in this that's too...
It's not like I watched Human Centipede when I was like
that. Yeah.
Where your son, on the other hand, he loved it.
Yeah.
It's like the face melt moment in Raiders Lost Ark.
Yeah.
A lot of guys around your age, that was a bit where I was like, what the fuck? And that stayed with you for a bit.
Definitely.
Yeah. Raiders,
I got fucked up by that, of all things, Roald Dahl, The Witches.
Roald
Dahl film. There's a scene where Angelica Houston peels her
face. Oh, yeah, right.
It's still down there. People do mark that as a really scary, scary film.
It's kind of creepy as well. Because at the start of the film, when they're all stuck in the painting and everything.
That's
well,
it. And even the subject is, the ending doesn't really he doesn't stop being a mouse, for example.
No,
right, he's still a mouse.
Kind of dark.
This film's
pretty apart from the girl being shot, it's kind of it's harmless kind of
thing.
Cowboys and Indians
exactly
pretty much.
Yeah, you're right
but that was really cool. I think I watched it when I was younger and I didn't get a full appreciation for it, but rewatching it again recently, from a filmmaking point of view, there's some really the way it's the visual storytelling I was mentioning before, it's cut together really well. Some of those action scenes.
If you were to do a remake now, because obviously we're talking about the remake, I don't think it was that good.
No.
But what would be the essence if you were to pitch me one? Okay, you want to approach me about Precinct 13, the remake, in one sentence? What would be the essence of your remake that will pay homage to? We'll do it right.
I think it's got to come back to what Carpenter was trying to do, which was it's the faceless mob attacking a group of people. You've got to focus, because that to me is where horror is scary, is when you don't know what's coming at you, and because you're leaving to the audience's imagination, and by having just it being kind of like a moment out of the blue and just.
But you never really get any. It's all the old. They're all wide shots, you're seeing shapes move in the dark,
Even wouldn't actually put faces to the warlords either. Maybe just have a random gun out the window as it's driving past, so you get that sense of danger and stuff. So you never really see the forces attacking. Yeah. So, but for me, it's not. I wouldn't say it's the best Carpenter film, but it was one that I have very strong nostalgic emotions over, and I really love it. And the music, as I said, to me, this is my favorite of his.
I think this is the start of his run of.
Yeah,
of classics. He had one of the best runs in history.
Oh, hell yeah!
And I think this is the start.
We're gonna get talking into that. Gonna start, because we've had Dark Stars, as that was a student film essentially, and he's teaming up to kind of basically did that at university, as we've discussed.
And if you compare him to Craven, like he got good quicker.
Yeah,
like his films got
hit his stride really, really quickly.
Yeah.
So that basically concludes our second horror film surgery for the season. We do hope you enjoyed our discussions. Until next time, we are Ben Skinner.
What's the opposite of punta?
Good nobbins?
Yes.
No, that's good evening. Yeah.
Write in and tell us.
You should have done ciao, Italian. You should have gone ciao, because it's hello and goodbye. So, anyway.
Oh, that's true. Or ciao bella.
Ciao bella. And Anthony Yee.
See ya.
And that just leaves me, your humble host, Paul Farrell. Until next time, goodbye.
You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The early years.
Assault on Precinct 13.
Music supplied by Peter Nezick. For more discussions or podcasts, head over to surgeonsofhorror.com or head over to our Facebook and Twitter sites for the latest news and updates.